U.S. President Joe Biden gives Ukraine the green light to strike Russian territory with U.S. missiles, a move supported by Britain.
We must double down on our support for Ukraine.
So what could this mean for the future of Russia's war on Ukraine?
Nothing the United States can do at this point can help Ukraine to reclaim its territory in the east. And it looks unlikely it'll be able to hold the territory that it has in Russia. So this decision is really operationally unnecessary and really strategically unwise.
Today is Monday, November 18th, and this is The Issue from VOA.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.
When you look at escalation of this conflict, it has been Russia that has escalated the conflict time and time again.
President Joe Biden's administration will allow Ukraine to use U.S.-made missiles to strike deep into Russia, according to two U.S. officials and a source familiar with the decision.
It's a significant reversal of Washington's policy in the Ukraine-Russia conflict. Without revealing details due to operational security concerns, the sources said Ukraine plans to conduct its first long-range attacks in the coming days.
Let's get some more now from Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan.
Moscow has hit back at reports of a U.S. decision to allow Ukraine to fire American missiles deep into Russian territory. The Kremlin on Monday warned any such decision by President Joe Biden's administration would escalate the conflict and would mean Washington was directly involved. When asked about reports by the New York Times and Reuters on the decision, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov noted they were not based on any official statement. However, Peskov pointed to comments made by Russian President Vladimir Putin in September about such a proposed step. He said using NATO military infrastructure and personnel for the operation would mean the direct involvement of NATO, including the United States and European countries in the war in Ukraine. Peskov also said the outgoing U.S. administration would be adding fuel to the fire and provoking tensions. Sources quoted in both the New York Times and Reuters reports presented the move as partly in response to the reported arrival of North Korean soldiers in Russia's Kursk region to help repel a Ukrainian incursion. Ukraine's seizure of a piece of the Kursk region marked the first use of U.S. weapons on internationally recognized sovereign Russian soil since the 2022 invasion. Russian officials have cautioned the West against pressing the limits of what a nuclear power might tolerate. Putin has changed Russia's nuclear doctrine to say any conventional attack on Russia aided by a nuclear power would be considered to be a joint attack. In late October, Putin said his defense ministry was working on responses if the United States and its NATO allies helped Ukraine with long-range missile strikes.
Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer agrees with the US decision.
We must double down on our support for Ukraine. Tomorrow is day 1,000 of the conflict. That's 1,000 days of aggression from Russia and 1,000 days of sacrifice from Ukraine. So that is my clear message here. It's number one on my agenda.
Russia says Ukraine cannot fire the missiles at targets inside Russia without direct help from NATO allies, calling this a major escalation. But the EU foreign chief, Josep Borrell, says Russia can't escalate the war with other countries and then call out Ukraine for doing the same.
It's clear that each step that is being left without reaction encourages Russia to escalate further. No reaction, more escalation. They started by weaponizing food, by weaponizing energy, using the winter as an arm. Then they resort to Iranian drones and missiles and military supplies from North Korea, and now even with non-Korean soldiers in the borders of Ukraine. And then they call to China, and the role of China is becoming bigger and bigger. China is today the largest provider of dual-use goods and sensitive items that sustain Russia's military industrial base. Without North Korea, without Iran, without China, Russia could not support its military effort, could not continue fighting the war. And certainly we are concerned by reports of production and deliveries of complete weapon systems from these three countries, but in particular is North Korea and Iran.
That is also the position from the White House. Here's National Security Advisor John Finer.
The fire was lit by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So I think this notion of fuel on the fire is frankly a side issue to the main issue, which is Russia waging a war of aggression across a sovereign border.
Well, Scott, this certainly is an interesting turn of events. And at this point in time, given that, the Biden administration is winding down and only going to be in office for a couple more months.
The White House did react to that comment by saying the American people elected Joe Biden to be president for 4 years, not 3 years and 10 months.
Fair enough. All right, well, let's get some insights with Jennifer Kavanaugh, Senior Fellow and Director of Military Analysis with Defense Priorities.
So thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me.
So a lot of people have been saying for a long time that no matter what we do to help Ukraine, they can't win this war. Is this another one of those decisions, do you think?
I do. The biggest problem that Ukraine faces right now is manpower, not number of weapons or types of weapons or permissions on those weapons. So almost nothing the United States can do at this point can help Ukraine to reclaim its territory in the east. And it looks unlikely it'll be able to hold the territory that it has in Russia. So this decision is really operationally unnecessary and really strategically unwise.
Why do you think the Biden administration now, with only 2 months left in the term, would begin to allow Ukraine to be doing this?
I think there's a number of reasons why the Biden administration might have done it now. The reason that they're giving is that this is a response to Russia's inclusion of the North Korean forces in their Kursk offensive. There are other possible reasons. One is Biden is on his way out. And may feel a need to try to salvage what he can from what has really been a failed Ukraine policy. Another, slightly more cynical, is to try to box in the next administration. Now, an incoming Trump administration will have to make a decision about whether or not to remove these permissions, which could be politically difficult, given the views in U.S. Congress as well as European allies. But I do think there are significant risks to this decision. There's obviously the risk of vertical escalation, attacks on NATO countries. I think the risk is pretty low, but it's always on the table. There's a risk of horizontal escalation, more sabotage campaigns in Europe, Russia sending missiles to the Houthi rebels who are firing at U.S. ships in the Red Sea. And then there's the risk of retaliation on Ukraine. Putin knows that Trump wants to end this war. And his main goal at this point is to increase his leverage for those upcoming negotiations. So he has really no incentive to be restrained in how he retaliates against Ukraine if Ukraine uses these missiles to fire deep inside of Russia.
So let's talk about the missiles and the potential targets and such. They don't have many of these missiles. What would they likely use them to hit in the beginning?
Well, it seems like the most likely use is going to be to protect Ukrainian soldiers who are trying to fight in Kursk. So the main things that Ukrainian forces will probably fire at are things like Russian weapon stockpiles and supply lines to try to force them to move those supply lines back to slow them down and to degrade some of their military capabilities. Also to try to hit air bases. Russia has been effective in using glide bombs to hit both Ukrainian cities and Ukrainian forces by targeting those air bases. Ukraine could make that more difficult. But in all of these cases, the obstacles that Ukraine would put up by targeting these sites is pretty minor. Russia can very easily move these supply lines, these stockpiles out of range of those weapons. They're not actually long-range weapons. They only go about 190 miles. And as they have throughout the war, Russia's likely to be able to adapt. So any gain is going to be really, really temporary. And as you said, there aren't that many missiles. So it's not like Ukraine can barrage the Russian targets.
And will the decision change the course of the war potentially? White House National Security Advisor John Finer had said that Russia has no right to say that the U.S. move regarding Ukraine is putting fuel on the fire, given its own actions.
I mean, certainly it's not going to change the balance of power on the military battlefield. So it's not going to be the thing that helps Ukraine to regain advantage or turn the tide. If anything, the bigger risk is that it changes the trajectory in the war in the sense that it pushes Russia to escalate in ways that damage U.S. interests or that actually hurt Ukraine. And that damage its ability and its leverage when the negotiations ultimately start. By giving these permissions, the United States is in some ways encouraging Ukraine to continue to commit resources in Kursk and into offensive operations, when what it really should be doing is doubling down on its defensive investments to protect the front lines on the Eastern Front, which are rapidly collapsing. So it's not necessarily the right move for Ukraine either. And potentially compromises its position at the negotiating table later on.
There are European countries also considering the same thing, allowing them to use some of the offensive weapons inside Russia. If the United States were to revoke the permissions or the U.S. missiles, they run out of them and the resupply is slow, do you think European nations might step up and allow them to do the same?
I would think that it's likely that they will move to also allow these, assuming that the Biden administration okays it, at least temporarily while we're in this transition period. As I understood it, the big holdup wasn't the willingness of the United Kingdom or France to allow their long-range missiles to be used inside of Russia, but their desire to have Biden's approval, mostly for alliance cohesion reasons, not for any specific legal reason. So now that Biden has given this permission, I would expect that at least temporarily the European countries would do the same. The question then is sort of how long this lasts. If the Trump administration comes in and revokes the permissions, then do the European countries also revoke their permissions if there are stockpiles left? That's a tough question to answer, but it does raise another important issue, which is how this decision and its longer-term implications into the next administration will affect U.S.-European relationships, which is already rather tense as European countries anticipate what the Trump administration's policies towards Europe and NATO will be.
And the Russian spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, alluded to the fact that NATO military infrastructure and personnel for the operation would mean direct involvement of NATO, including the U.S. and European countries, in the war in Ukraine. Is that just hyperbole, or is that a legitimate concern from or comment from the Russians' perspective?
Well, it is true that use of these long-range missiles does require significant support from the United States, and similarly for the European systems. The Ukrainians are dependent on the United States not only for intelligence but also for of the targeting and programming information that's used to fire the missiles. So it actually does represent a qualitative step up in the U.S. involvement in the war. It's still not direct. So there are no U.S. personnel actually firing the missiles or actually on the ground. But it is a change and an increase in the U.S. involvement. The Russian spokesperson is correct about that.
What's the end game, do you think? The Russian offensive keeps taking more land. They don't have enough soldiers to send to the front. The relationship with the United States is about to change dramatically. Europe can only do what Europe can do. You know, they're very slow to react, and they don't have the weapons capability to replace what the U.S. is giving them. So where are we 4 months, 5 months, 6 months from now?
Well, the war is going to end in some kind of negotiated settlement that will unfortunately require Ukraine to give up some territory, at least temporarily. I think the big questions that are still out there are what is required to get Putin and Zelensky to the negotiating table. Right now, Putin has very little incentive to negotiate. He has the upper hand. He's gaining more territory. So what actually gets him to the negotiating table? There's going to have to be something more than just territory. That could be delaying or putting off Ukraine's NATO membership. It could be an end to some of the sanctions. It could be removal of threats of Russian war reparations, you know, what's going to get him to the table? So that's one question. And then the second question is sort of, what is the battlefield? What's the balance of power look like at the time those negotiations start? And how much leverage do the two sides have in terms of what the final line of demarcation ends up being between what is effectively at least temporarily Russian territory and what remains part of an independent Ukraine? So I think those are the questions. In reality, Ukraine's negotiating position gets worse over time. It was probably much stronger in 2022 had Biden pushed, as some suggested, for an early settlement. That ends up looking like the sort of the best, would have been Ukraine's best move. But we are where we are now. In my view, the sooner the better. But that does require getting Putin to the negotiating table.
But ultimately, you know, the argument has been, and I'm wondering if this is the case, you know, if you're a country that's allowed to invade another country, a sovereign nation, and take territory and call it your own, if this is where it ends up anyway, what's to stop them from continuing in other places?
Well, I think military capabilities is a big limiting factor. Russia thought that this war would be over in a couple of weeks at most. And here we are several years later, and it's still ongoing. The Russian military has been able to adapt, and they have certainly had some successes, especially recently. But overall, I think the big takeaway from the U.S. and from NATO countries' perspective should be that the Russian military actually didn't perform all that well at all. Certainly, European countries with their much larger GDP and total population, were they to make a concerted effort, could build a defense infrastructure, even without the U.S. support, that would prevent any sort of Russian moves on NATO territory. So I just think that the idea that Russia is going to go from gaining, 20% of Ukrainian territory, if that's what it ends up being, to launching a major invasion of Europe, is a little bit far-fetched and doesn't really match up with the kind of battlefield realities that we've observed over the past several years. There's also very little indication that Putin has an interest or a desire to take over huge parts of Europe. So I think that there's neither the intent nor the capability for that kind of move. But I don't disagree with your point that, of course, this is not the outcome anyone would have wanted. This idea that might makes right is something that the world has tried to move beyond over the past, 75 years since the end of World War II. So I do think it is a development that we should view with some concern. But at the same time, there has to be a degree of realism to how this war ends. Continuing to pour resources into Ukraine isn't going to change the situation. It could even make it worse. So being realistic and trying to bring the war to an end is still probably the best decision for both the United States and its interests, as well as for Europe and Ukraine.
Hmm. Jennifer, thank you so much for the time and the perspective.
Thanks for having me.
That was Jennifer Kavanaugh, a senior fellow and director of military analysis with Defense Priorities.
She is saying the same thing that so many of the people that we talk to say. Number one, Ukraine can't win the war. Number two, their best case scenario is a negotiated peace and that they're likely going to have to give up some territory. They say they can win the war, Lori.
True, but, everybody thought this would be over in a matter of days. Look where it is. So obviously they certainly are strong-willed in their efforts to stand up for their country.
Well, we expect major changes in U.S. policy in a couple of months when the Trump administration takes over. So we'll see what happens then. If what happens is the U.S. becomes much softer on the Ukraine war, which is what we expect, will Europe step up to the plate and fill the void we expect to be left by the new U.S. policy?
Right. And will it be enough? You have been listening to The Issue from the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for listening.
can follow The Issue on X and Facebook at VOA The Issue. And for news 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Lori London. We will talk to you tomorrow.